Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions.
Emily.
Hi.
How was your week?
Okay, let me start this week by actually putting a timestamp on this recording. It's the 13th of March, 2024. And I got COVID 4 years ago today. Or 4 years ago today, I went to a school swimming gala, followed by going to dinner with 13 of us, where everyone ended up with COVID. So I have had long COVID for 4 years. And today I'm really not great.
I can see you shaking from here.
So I've woken up today with back to quite bad symptoms. I've got the tremors. I've got the constriction in my throat. My head is incredibly painful. Everything is, I feel like I'm being poisoned. So for all of the incremental gains that I feel like I've made, and I am really, really grateful that I am not in the situation that I was in 2.5 years ago, there is still something poisoning my body. There is still something stuck in my system that I have not alleviated. For all the little bits that I feel every day, I'm doing so much better. It's not gone.
No. Honestly, today I haven't seen you shake this bad for a while.
We should go back and listen to old episodes to see the trajectory.
Yeah.
But there are definitely things that I don't have so badly anymore, but there are other things that are possibly getting worse than they were. Like, I definitely get more heart pain. I don't know. It's different. It's morphed, but I'm not recovered. You know, I always tell you most weeks that I'm better. But my love, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm just okay. I have back pain, which is weird. I've had it for a while. It honestly feels, I've said this before, it feels like something's gripped my spine and has made it tight. It's not painful, it's just uncomfortable. And it kind of moves around my back. Sometimes it's lower, sometimes it's higher. Today it's in the middle.
Does it feel inflamed?
I don't know. Honestly, I give up. It's just one thing after another, isn't it? One weird symptom after another. Anyway, yeah. The back pain I've had on and off for all the time I've had long COVID now. And originally, when I got this type of back pain, I took myself off because it really feels like something is in my spine, just stopping it moving around.
Wow.
Like a tightness. And I took myself off, oh God, this is years ago now, to have a scan of my back because I was sure I'd got something in there, like a growth or something that was making it. And now I'm just used to it. Like, I won't even bother getting it checked out.
That's the thing. And I was talking to another friend with long COVID. There are so many things that now come up in our body that we don't necessarily go and get checked.
I mean, I noticed that. Look at my eyes. I have these panda circles I have not been able to get rid of for months.
Is that because you haven't slept for months and months?
It could be that I haven't slept, but also when I do sleep, they don't go. So it's like I never catch up on my sleep. Or now they're just permanent. It's horrid. I feel like I'm 100 when I look at my face. So I try not to take any pictures or look in the mirror. Hence, I always look a state.
I can see in my face when I'm not very well. I can see the inflammation. It actually in my whole body, it's kind of gets puffy. I think you've spoken about that before, just feeling puffy.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's edema, but I think this illness has a lot to answer for, to be honest with you. If we weren't ill, we would be absolutely stunning here. We would just be radiant. This haggardness is just the illness, not the age.
It's definitely the illness. And I've also started to go grey.
Have you?
Maybe it's my age, but I never had any grey.
I've got a completely receded hairline. I've lost so much hair that my forehead is way bigger than it used to be. That is a fact.
My hair's a lot thinner. I lose lots of hair every time I have a crash.
And that might be the iron deficiency we looked at last episode. But if I lose much more hair, I am going to be bald.
No, you're not. It grows back.
My nails are still quite bad, but I actually was having dreams about losing my toenails. And that is, I think, partly because when I said that certain things are getting worse that I didn't have before, one of the things, and I've mentioned it to you a few times and not mentioned it on here yet, is my toes in my left foot when I walk go numb, really numb, even if it's not particularly cold. And now when I get back from walking, I take my shoe off and the end of all of my toes have gone bright white. And that's something that we've seen on social, isn't it?
Yeah, I need a picture though. You need to take a picture for me.
I did take a photo the other day, but I thought I'd spare you it.
Listen, I've seen your armpit. It's fine, I'll see your toes. We say things have morphed. My heart stuff seems to have gotten so much better.
Which is a huge relief.
It is a huge relief. The palpitations were the one thing that I just used to drive me insane.
Yeah.
It was super worrying because you think your heart's going to stop. But this week I've been breathless. When I went out for a walk, I was pretty breathless, which I hadn't been for a while.
I have that today.
Like, you just do anything and you're just like... And the other thing is... I'm starting to get headaches, like daily little niggles.
So did you give me the heart thing and I gave you the headache?
Probably.
We've not even been in the same room. How have we exchanged? It's just an energy transfer, maybe.
Maybe this is the course of the disease.
It's interesting the way it's changed, isn't it, in both of us. Let's be positive, okay? Because you know I love to be positive. Mine is much more manageable, but as we've discussed before, perhaps that's just that we understand how to pace better. And we can have all the understanding we want. When people say to us, and there have been comments, why don't you two learn to pace better? We would just like to mention that we do pace as well as we possibly can, given that we have to keep two children alive much of the time on our own. And say, in a perfect world, we would rest much more and do far less. But we have to keep working and we have to keep our children alive. So there are certain pressures on us that perhaps mean that we can't pace as well as other people can.
I also feel like I am doing 15% of what I would normally do.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm pacing.
Yeah.
Like I'm not doing any of the extra stuff that I would normally do without even thinking.
No.
And that's partly because I'm trying to pace and partly because I just can't. I do what I can do. And so your energy goes into what you need to do. Like your body, when it shuts down, it just goes to your organs.
Yeah.
For us, we are just concentrating on the kids, getting them from A to B, making sure there's food in the fridge, that the shopping's done, that we can do this podcast.
Yeah.
And if there's any room for anything else, we'll give it a go.
And that's definitely the socializing and things is all of the things that you might view as being somehow extraneous, not essential, are the things that have fallen off in our lives. I do believe that those are really essential for rebuilding our well-being and nervous systems and things, but we can only do as much as we can do. In terms of this week's guest, I do definitely feel that this is autonomic in me, that this is something in my nervous system, something because of the way that it manifests. And obviously I have a lot of the neurological symptoms, but I feel like I need to heal my nervous system. And I know that you think I'm super woo-woo and we do need to get rid of the COVID in my body, but oh, I remember what last week was. I'd had that awful reaction to an MRI and I said that that was going to clear the viral residue from my body. Just to let you know, that didn't happen. I've still got the viral residue in my body, if that's the theory that is correct.
Why did I think you'd had a good couple of weeks? You didn't. You were awful last week.
I know, and I had a crash on Friday. So, yeah, you've now caught my long COVID amnesia, so you forget when I've had a crap time as well, so that we can live in our lovely positive bubble.
Well, I woke up this morning thinking, you know, we're going to record today. How's my week been? And I just, it's just such a beige week. Oh, and it's Ramadan and I'm fasting. So now I'm, and maybe that'll clear my COVID.
Yeah. How do you feel?
Fine.
Fasting did actually seem to help you a little bit when you did quite an intense fast a while ago, didn't it?
It really did, yes. And then I had a crash. So nothing helps. Time is the best healer.
Time is the best healer. 4 years, I think, is quite a long time.
But we did speak to someone recently, we haven't put the episode out yet, who told us that it's a 5-year mean average for recovery.
Yeah, we can say that. The only problem is that is based on SARS. We haven't yet got to 5 years with anyone with long COVID, so we don't actually know. But I guess that suggests that some people are recovering within a couple of years.
Yeah.
And we are doing so much better, Noreen, aren't we?
100%, we are. We're doing so much more as well.
We are. And I was thinking about that. I think that I am living a much more normal life. And I also find a lot of things a lot easier. My diary is quite full each day. I don't get panicked if I don't have days where I've got a completely free diary to sleep, because I am able to cope with life better.
I just need to sort my sleep out.
Yeah.
Because my days are packed at the moment.
So in terms of this week's guest, we spoke to Dr. Thomas Chalimsky, who's a neurologist and autonomic specialist from VCU.
And he works in partnership with Ron Garbo, who we've had on before.
Yes, episode 55, if you want to go back and listen to that.
They make a good team, these two. I suffer a lot with POTS, so it was really a good conversation. He had a lot of practical things to offer.
He did, and he talks extensively about migraine. We spoke to Ron Garbo back in the middle of last year about the work that he had been doing on autonomic rehabilitation.
Yes.
Can we go right back and hear how you became involved, or your department became involved, in long COVID?
We started the clinic in September of 22, and I have forever been an autonomic specialist in neurology. And one of the hats that a person like me wears is to see a lot of patients who have POTS, or postural tachycardia syndrome. And that matches the complaint of many patients who have long COVID. So as a result of that, I started seeing a lot of patients who have long COVID. And so the involvement with long COVID is really the piece that not many physicians see or treat, which is where they have what we call an orthostatic intolerance picture. People presented to me with problems of inability to stand for long periods of time, symptoms, dizziness, lightheadedness, withstanding, and often tachycardia withstanding. So they basically have what we call POTS, which stands for postural tachycardia syndrome. And that is a disorder in which inadequate amounts of blood get back to the brain, and is thought to involve the venous side of the equation, where the pump is not working well. So not enough blood gets back to the heart. As a result, the heart is not able to pump enough blood to the brain. And as a result of that, a person feels that they correctly, it's not just a perception, they feel that when they stand up, their brain is not functioning, and they get fatigued and so on. And then that can extend to other areas. It doesn't just happen only when they're standing, but the part where they're standing is the part where I can play a significant role, because I know how to help and manage that.
The brilliant explanation of the route that you have just described. And I think that one of the things that you do whilst you are a neurologist is you are able to have a fairly holistic view of the patient and the way that it affects their entire body. What is the basis? Where does this issue stem from? Is it from the heart? Is it from the brain? What, in your opinion, causes this POTS?
That's an excellent question. Let me first state that there are many theories out there. And I think there are probably as many theories as there are POTS specialists and POTS investigators. Now, we think we know the answer, but I don't want to pretend like it is the answer. I just want to tell you what I think. Let me present what I think and present the background of what I think, first of all. So it's very interesting that POTS generally doesn't show up alone. POTS typically shows up in people who also have developed perhaps migraine headaches or fibromyalgia or irritable bowel syndrome. It is very, very rare. It is the rare exception to see a patient who has just POTS and nothing else. And so that's one important observation. The second important observation is that long COVID is the new kid on the block right now, but it's a new kid. There are old kids too. So we knew for years that mononucleosis was in a certain percent of patients who had mono, maybe 2 or 3%. People developed POTS after that. It could occur after a severe bout with influenza. And it can occur after other types of trauma, such as a car accident, a traumatic brain injury, or even a severe emotional trauma, like somebody experienced a sexual assault, or they had the sudden loss of a very close person. So as a result, the concept that we have broadened to the idea that this was really a post-traumatic event based on those two observations, the one that it's not just long COVID, and the second is that there's other things go along with it. Now, we know with chronic pain disorders that there is a change in the way the brain operates. And we came up with a theory to account for all of this. At this point, we're very actively investigating this. We have some money to do some work in the brain to understand this better. But we believe there's a particular structure of the brain. The name is the periaqueductal gray region. That's the technical term because it goes around the aqueduct in the brain. It's in the brain stem. So if you think of the brain, it's got the brain sort of has that big picture of a gigantic oval on top of a little stem. This particular structure is at the very top of that stem. And its job is to figure out if you're being threatened or not as a person, if you're being threatened. And very interestingly, it bifurcates into two pathways. Pathway number one, you're entering a survivable threat. It is likely that you'll be able to survive because you can run or you can fight and you're going to survive. In which case, that structure then increases the blood flow to your hind limbs, increases the blood flow to your brain. It really sort of like an adrenergic rush and you just are at attention. The second pathway is a pathway where the structure, due to the input it receives from the cortex and other parts of the brain, decides that this is not a survivable threat, that you're not going to make it. And so then it programs you for death. So it then causes hypotension and it causes low heart rate, bradycardia, and a complete quiescence and actually paralyzes you using the same paths that occur in REM sleep. We all know that during REM sleep, dream sleep, we are paralyzed so we don't act out our dreams. That's the exact same pathway that this uses. But now this is in life. This is while you're awake. And I had a colleague who reported that he got attacked by a lion. And I didn't understand it at the time. Someone shot the lion, but not until he had lost his arm. And in the attack, he said the most frightening thing was that he was completely paralyzed. He was not able to move anything.
So is that what we describe as the flight or fight? And then the other side is the freeze.
Exactly. Exactly. So when we talk about fight, flight, freeze, we sometimes talk about it as a single entity. But in fact, it's two entities. It's fight, flight versus freeze. They're two separate things. And it's known that when the system produces a freeze, when your nervous system produces a freeze, the long-term consequences, such as things like PTSD and depression, are very severe. There's a Swedish group who studied that in women who have been sexually assaulted. And those who experienced a freeze during the assault were at much greater risk for having serious psychological consequences for that, meaning PTSD and depression. So the theory of what POTS would be that you got this periaqueductal gray got into this non-survivable mode and never got out. So the off switch didn't turn off. So as a result, you have this tonic central nervous system influence on the body such that there's inadequate return of blood to the brain. But the problem is not with the veins. The problem is not with the blood return. The problem is not even with the nerves. The problem is with the central command system that still thinks you're in a post-traumatic period where the trauma is still going on because the switch never got turned off. So in this model, the idea would be that COVID is the trauma and that it's turned on this switch, and long COVID is the failure to turn off the switch. And that would explain why these other disorders that we know are related to trauma as well, things like migraine, IBS, or to unmanaged stress, if you will, fibromyalgia, would co-occur with POTS, because we know that those things happen in that context as well.
As you were talking about this duct, is this duct influenced by the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system then? Is that what you're saying, that that's where the malfunction has happened?
Yes, you're correct, but the other way around. So it's called the periaqueductal gray region. Gray means it's a bunch of cell bodies as opposed to a bunch of nerve wires. So white versus gray. And periaqueductal is an aqueduct that contains spinal fluid. So that is where the spinal fluid goes from those very large ventricles that, if you've seen MRIs or CTs of the brain, you see those fluid spaces. They're very large, but they ultimately go into this very tiny little duct that is probably about 2 millimeters around. So all of it has to squeeze through there. And this structure happens to be located around that area. I think there are reasons why it's located around the area. But we could call this structure the head autonomic center. It controls both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. Of course, it doesn't do it willy-nilly on its own. It has input from many structures, most notably the insula and the amygdala from the cortex, frontal areas, parietal areas. So many areas influence how this structure manages the autonomic nervous system. But all of it has to go through, any control of the autonomic nervous system goes through this structure, which ultimately has the ultimate say of what's turned on. Is it sympathetic? Is it parasympathetic? So to follow what you just said, then, we believe that when you're in this persistent state of freeze, if you will, so maybe call it a prolonged freeze, then the sympathetic system, the fight flights system in a certain way, is now much too active and unopposed by what we would call normally the rest digest system, which is the vagus system. And so this has to be turned off so that the periaqueductal gray can say, okay, resume normal operations. So a little bit as though somebody had pulled the emergency brake on a train and the conductor had restarted the train without releasing the brake.
Can you also then explain, whilst we are creating this visual picture of the brain, how the vagal nerve ties into what you've just described?
Absolutely. The vagal nerve is a nerve that is composed, about 80 to 90% of it is actually information going into the brain, and about 10 or 20% is information going out of the brain to influence things like the heart, the gut, the internal organs, the pancreas, the spleen. And it has an amazing amount of control over all of our inner functions. So some areas that perhaps we're not so familiar with is that it controls the immune system. So for example, one of the best ways to control rip-roaring and unresponsive rheumatoid arthritis is to actually stimulate the vagus nerve. You stimulate the vagus nerve, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the vagal nerve is a site where you stimulate for people that have seizures. And in that case, you're using the information that's going into the brain to influence from the vagus, which is 80% of those nerves, to influence the brain and reduce seizures. In the case of the immune system, we're doing the exact same stimulation, but now we're taking advantage of the information going out of the brain to modulate how the immune system is working. And it is a very powerful immunoprotective. So we can think of sympathetic, fight, flight, vagus nerve, parasympathetic, rest, digest, as being normally quite harmonized, and the rest, digest system is in charge. The sympathetic system then is playing to the rest, digest system. The rest, digest system says, for example, oh, we're having a, this is a, could be a very iffy social interaction. We need your help, sympathetics, come on in. But when the threat becomes so severe that it's life-threatening or perceived as life-threatening, then the balance shifts and now the sympathetics take the lead and the rest digest system no longer has the lead. So that's why, for example, you've heard that stress is associated with autoimmune disorders like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. So excessive unmanaged stress, and there's a lot of talk today that our restless lives in the cities are getting worse and worse with all the technology. And that's why you're seeing a rise in the autoimmune disorders, because the amount of stress is simply unmanageable. This would be a mechanism that would explain why that is, because when fight flight starts taking over, the vagus nerve, which is really the topic of this question, functions less effectively and so loses control over the immune system. But I don't want to downplay the fact that they're always playing together. It's just a question of which one is in charge. The vagus never turns off and the sympathetics never turn off. It's really a question of which is the one that is dominating. And just to be clear, the nerves themselves don't have any part in that decision. That decision process is all central in this area I call the periaqueductal gray. So that decision of who's going to dominate is a brain decision, not a nerve decision. The nerves just do what they're told to do.
Now, looking at that theory, therefore, does it mean that the trauma that then goes on to create this freeze situation, is the trauma physiological or psychological, be that conscious or unconscious? Is it something that our brains have done, or is it something that the COVID virus has physically done?
I honestly don't know. And I honestly don't think it really matters. And this or question is actually a Descartesian question that goes way back to the French philosopher and physician Descartes, who I believe erroneously claimed that the body and the brain, there's really a duality, which I actually don't ascribe to. I don't believe there's duality. So I don't actually believe there's an or. So I don't believe, for example, a person can have breast cancer without having a deep psychological impact from that occurrence. Both pre-knowing, just there would be some connection between the cancer and the brain at some subconscious level. And once they know, of course, then it becomes a very deep psychological impact. But I think the brain and body are one, which is why you see examples of people who can overcome such profound issues that are physical through brain strategies. So I understand what you're asking, but I'm going to beg the question and say, I don't actually like the premise of it.
I like your response, because all through this, I have been learning so much about the mind-body connection. And learning more and more, the more doctors that I actually see, how they are disassociated in our Western medical system so often. And it is problematic. If we took an approach where they were considered together, I think that the results would actually be quite remarkable if we didn't try and treat the two separately.
I agree with you 100%. And that is the approach we take in our clinic. So for example, when people come to see us at VCU, they automatically are booked with Dr. Garbo, who you could say is a bottom-up approach. Dr. Mary Wells, who's a psychologist, is a top-down approach, meaning that she's really utilizing the brain and its power to help the person do better. And then I see myself as the sandwiched specialty. I'm between the two, reaching out to both. And if a person, for example, says, well, I don't want to see a psychologist, then we'll say, well, then you probably aren't going to get help from our center, so we're not going to schedule you.
Well, that's what we'd call an MDT unit that we don't get access to in England, but that's quite formidable. So shall we talk about the practicalities of treating people with long COVID that come and see you? When they first come through the door, what do you do? What do you say? What's the initial assessment like? And then obviously we can go to some of the ways that you treat them.
Let me just say that our assessment also, so my wife is a pediatric gastroenterologist and she'll see people up to the age of 30 to help us on the gastrointestinal side because we don't have an adult gastroenterologist interested in motility and how the brain-gut connection works.
Which is an area much overlooked in this. As someone who has just now been referred to a gastroenterologist, the disconnect between all of this is really quite profound.
Yeah. Well, we're back to this Cartesian concept, which I think it's time to abandon it to the benefit of the patients. But they would either be seen, depending on their age, they'd be seen by three or four of us. They would be seen by typically me first, Dr. Garbo, Dr. Wells, and the other Dr. Chalimsky in pediatric gastroenterology. We also have a pediatric clinic, of course, and then we have a different psychologist. But the team concept is the same. And each of us is teasing out what is the major process going on. So there are as many physiological phenomena as there are patients. Every patient presents in a slightly different way. So we're teasing out what is dominant, what is there but not really that important, and what issues are not present. So, for example, I would tease out if the person is having significant upright symptoms or are their symptoms really not related to being upright. And I would say about half of the patients come with dizziness, but their dizziness is really not related to being upright. So it's been assumed that they have POTS, for example. But then when you do the heart rates and the blood pressures, interesting, they don't really change that much. We can do them formally in autonomic testing, so we can send them to the autonomic lab. If we really want to know everything that's going on, we do that in probably 3/4 of the patients, where we can do a tilt table test to see how they respond to this challenge of being tilted upright. Then we can measure the Valsalva maneuver. We can measure the vagus nerve in terms of their response to deep breathing. And we can also see if they have an autonomic neuropathy or not. And it's amazing to me that as many long COVID patients come, as many patterns as there are. So some patients have damage to their autonomic nerves. So that has to be addressed. And is that an immunologic process? So if it's an immunologic process, then I have to think about, do I need to use immunologic methods? Of course, within me, I understand that if they have this immunologic thing, most likely there was a vagal disconnect that produced that. But I don't have the tools to reconnect it. So I've got to now use immunologic tools to fight an immunologic process, even though I believe it's due to a central nervous system abnormality. So I sort of, when I talk to the patients, I sort of talk to them about, okay, well, we got the band-aids, glorified band-aids, where we are mitigating the effects of what COVID did to either your body or your nervous system. So, for example, if I used a trial of some steroids or some IV globulin to try to modify the immune system, I'm still just kind of at the band-aid end. I'm still sort of at the end where I'm just changing how the COVID impacted their immune system, but I'm not changing the immune system back to normal. That's why I call it a band-aid. I'm just sort of giving them something that's going to correct that abnormality in their body. So that's what I do. But I'm sort of the least important because I'm the Band-Aid guy. What Dr. Garbo and Dr. Wells do are far more important because they're not the Band-Aid people. But it takes way longer. It might take a year for them to work through the trauma of the COVID. And that said, I just want to put it aside. It's amazing how many patients, I would say half of them, have another trauma along that, right at that same time that nobody paid attention to. Because I have this model, which could be right, could be wrong, but I'm paying a lot of attention to trauma. So they lost their grandmother, you know, it's a 16-year-old kid, and they lost their grandmother to whom they were very close 3 months before they got COVID. And maybe that's why the COVID was so bad, because they were already down from another trauma. Now, you know, we're saying, okay, psychological trauma, but it's still a body trauma. It's a, you know, it's this unified system. Or they had a car accident or something. And it's also interesting that the way we portray it to people, because we don't want them to hear the message, okay, it's in your head, because that's not what we're saying. We're saying it's one system. We're not saying it's in your head. So the way we say it has been very successful is to say, okay, your fight, flight, freeze system is stuck in the on position, and we need to work to get it off. And I have yet to have a patient say, no, that's not true. Everyone says, yeah, that's exactly how I feel inside. That's exactly how I feel. I feel exhausted. I feel like I'm fighting an inner battle. I can't get on top of. So that's where Dr. Garbo and Dr. Wells come in. Dr. Garbo has sort of a bottom-up simple approach. And I won't go into much detail because, first of all, I don't know as much as he does. And secondly, he's already conveyed that to you. So he's working through the body's side of influence on how the brain's functioning. And then Dr. Wells is working from a top-down approach of what kind of thoughts are destructive. What kind of thoughts are, this is a major loss for you. I can no longer do what I once did. Those thoughts have a major impact on not just your brain, but your body. Can we work through those? Can we find methods that help you, specifically you, meaning that it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, of course, to navigate through these very difficult thoughts.
That's so interesting, because it's not saying that you are depressed because you have long COVID, but it's saying if you've had this initial trauma, your psychological response to the trauma can then also impact it further, because you're struggling to come to terms with your new situation.
Exactly. The trauma may be not just the triggering trauma, but the ongoing trauma of the situation that you simply cannot currently accept or deal with.
It's interesting. I came to the realization recently that I'm much more accepting of my situation now. But even yesterday, I just got so incredibly frustrated that I don't have the same capacities that I used to have, and then got into a very negative thought process from it. But I hadn't actually contemplated the negative impact that might have on me physiologically.
You hit the nail on the head. So that is exactly correct. And then what Dr. Garbo is very good at doing is helping you to catch that moment. Catch it early. Don't let it sit with you for a long time. Catch it very early and move into a corrective mode rapidly. If you can move into corrective mode from the brain perspective, then move into corrective mode from the body perspective. That'll help you move into corrective mode from the brain perspective. Let me just harken back for a second to my evaluation. So I'm looking at the bodily functions. I'm looking at the gut. We have some patients who've lost a lot of weight. They have motility issues, which my wife addresses. We sometimes are debating, is the motility problem due to some effect of COVID on the nerve endings, which COVID can do, or is the problem a central one? If the problem is a central one, then we're trying to assess, could they be stuck in a migraine? And some patients are stuck in a migraine despite the fact that they don't actually have a headache. How do we know they're in a migraine? Because they have light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, chronic nausea. And at some point before this all started, there was a headache. The headache just kind of dissipated. And when I say migraine, I'm using the neurologic definition of migraine, not the common layperson. For a layperson, I'm not going to argue that. Of course, it's a very, very bad headache that puts you into bed. But migraine can also operate without the headache. It is a circuit that comes, interestingly, it comes from an area of the brain called the raphe, R-A-P-H-E, nucleus, which is intimately associated with the periaqueductal gray. It is next door. In fact, it's interesting. We published a paper in 2020 about the location of the periaqueductal gray. How do you localize it effectively in the brain? And the reason we published the paper is because most of the papers that had been written about the periaqueductal gray had localized it incorrectly. They were actually looking at the raphe, not knowing. They thought they were looking at the periaqueductal gray, but they're actually looking at the raphe nucleus, which is a completely different structure. It does different things, but it must be very tightly connected to the PAG because it's sitting right against it. They sit next to each other. So the migraine circuit, we believe, is generated in the raphe. And the migraine circuit doesn't have to have a headache associated with it. For example, there are kids who have what's called cyclic vomiting syndrome. That is a migraine, but has no headache associated. Other kids have abdominal migraine. They have stomach pain. And we've seen this in some of our adults with long COVID. They have recurrent abdominal pain. Nobody can explain it. And then, you know, I ask them, well, does light bother your eyes or does sound bother your ears when you get this stomach pain? And they go, yeah. Yeah, so, well, no one's asked me that question.
No one's asked me this question. I had a headache for 2.5 years. I still have problems with light, sound, my stomach, all over the place. And no one has once asked me any of those questions.
Yes. So those are the questions we ask because of the construct we're coming from. So everything is built on a construct. So we have a construct which is right or wrong, seems to be leading to successful treatment of many patients. We think we're onto something. We have a grant pending. We hope that it'll get funded so we can actually really investigate these connections and sort of prove or disprove that this is a major player, the periaqueductal gray.
So for Emily, for example, how would you treat these non-headache migraines? Because she very definitely has all the symptoms.
All of those symptoms and often the headache, but the headache now, thankfully, 2.5 years constant, now comes and goes.
Yeah. But the migraine probably does not. Really, what's happening is the headache is the tip of the iceberg, but the bottom of the iceberg is all the rest of the stuff. And that's ongoing. So we have several ways of treating that. The simplest way, if it responds, is really the medication called propranolol. And you put people on propranolol and this stuff melts away. The biggest thing is you have to combine propranolol with the bottom-up, top-down pieces. If you put somebody on a drug, how to best say this? The brain thinks it knows what it's doing. So it thinks you're supposed to have a headache. It thinks you're supposed to have all these symptoms because it thinks, in quotes, you think that these things are the way the system ought to be operating. So if you give somebody a drug, yes, you'll interfere with that, but the brain is smart enough to always eventually get around that unless you allow the brain to fix itself. And that's how I explain it to patients. So I'll give you a drug. If we're very lucky, we'll get 12 to 18 months out of it. Then it'll stop working because your brain will figure out a way around the drug because your brain is smarter than the drug. But if we train your brain to change how it is functioning and you use your brain skills, that is permanent. That will always be working. By the way, there's a very good book that I recommend written by Alan Gordon called The Way Out. I don't know if others have mentioned that to you.
No, but I have that book.
Okay. It's really about the new pain neuroscience. And if you, instead of putting in there pain, you put in there nausea or fatigue or light sensitivity or whatever substitutes your symptom, that is a very effective strategy. And the basic strategy there is to remove the fear components out of the symptom. So Emily, for example, you're so fatigued, you get frustrated. And part of that, whether you are conscious of it or not, is a fear of what that means about your life. And so what Gordon does with chronic pain, but you can do it with anything, is to sit with the symptom in a non-judgmental way. I'm fatigued. Okay, I'm going to sit with that symptom. And I'm not going to fear it. I'm safe. I'm okay. Because you're removing the connection to trauma. It seems very simple and very sort of light and easy, but it's very profound because as you disconnect the symptom from the original trauma, because trauma is associated with fear, then you actually change the brain circuits.
Which is why mindfulness and meditation have been probably the most helpful tools that I have found.
Exactly.
Without wanting to somehow psychologize my situation.
Well, psychologize is only a verb in the Descartesian world.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating.
So back to this migraine piece. If we discover that someone has a migraineous piece to their long COVID, which I would say is a good 50%, I would say half of them do, then the first would be to try propranolol if they don't also have asthma, for example, or have some contraindication, and push it to good solid doses. And propranolol can make you fatigued. And so the patient will immediately ask me, I'm already so tired. You're going to put me on a drug that makes me tired? And I explain, well, it would only make you tired if it's not working on the migraine. Right now, part of your fatigue is this ongoing migraine. And if propranolol wipes out the migraine, then you will gain energy. The balance of that will be a big energy gain. The second thing we can do is most migraines are responsive to various forms of steroids. I typically use prednisone. And you can do a 3 or 4 week course of prednisone to see if a person will respond. And that's also diagnostic, is helpful diagnostically. And the last go-to we have is a medication called dihydroergotamine that we use a lot, which is the best. It goes directly to the raphe nuclei and basically shuts that switch off. You have to be hospitalized for that. It has to be given in the hospital or via an infusion center. But it works extremely well to terminate a migraine. And of course, then you have to do the hard work, the meditation. And also, I don't want to forget about physical exercise to a level. We don't want to push people to a point where they are so fatigued that now they're 2 days down after they do their exercise. So it's very important to understand what the reserves are, what the capacities are. But, you know, everyone can do 5 minutes of something, and that's more than they were doing before. So you just figure out what that is. And that is also a language the body speaks back to the brain.
I think some people with long COVID would refute that point and say that they're not capable of doing 5 minutes of anything. What would you say in response to that from what you have seen with your patients?
I think it's all a matter of working with somebody, for example, an exercise physiologist or a physical therapist who really knows long COVID. I found the water to be an excellent environment where people can do stuff they couldn't do before because now you don't have the gravitational pull. It's really a question of starting slow and not exceeding capacities. There's not too many long COVID patients that are in bed continuously. If you're not in bed continuously, you're obviously doing something for 5 minutes during the day. And so the question is, what is that? And how do you harness that information into a positive exercise experience? And when I say exercise, that could be as little as just moving some arms or lying flat and moving your legs, but doing something consciously that then you can build upon. I think when people think of exercise, they think, well, you're asking me to go to the gym and, you know, and be on a treadmill. No, that's not what we're talking about.
We've spoken to POTS specialists in the past, and part of their repertoire has been water, salt, compression, garments. Do you use that with your patients?
I do. I do very extensively. And in fact, the patients who are referred to me, I would say the biggest failure is the lack of using enough salt. So they'll use drugs that increase blood pressure, like such as midodrine or pyridostigmine or other drugs that do that. But if they don't use salt, then the drugs remain ineffective. And the reason for that in layperson language is that you have to fill the well before you can pump the well.
What has been the effect on patients with these interventions, with these strategies?
Well, I wish I could say 100% respond. That's not the case. We have patients who are very debilitated, who have probably, and we've studied this as well, mitochondrial dysfunction. By the way, the vagus controls the mitochondria as well. That's another conversation. But the vagus can actually stop the mitochondria from functioning. And so we have patients who probably are so debilitated, it's just very hard to make any inroads. But that is the minority. I would say that's maybe 10%. In the majority, I think we uncover something that perhaps wasn't uncovered before. They're getting a strategy that they hadn't used before. And I would say the impact is typically very positive. We're just talking about this right now. How are we going to measure this? We're currently not measuring it in any meaningful structured way, like some survey or fatigue scale or something like this. Dr. Garbo does administer a fatigue scale to every one of his patients, and fatigue typically will drop. It's a 60-point scale. He's dropping down into the 30s, not zero. It's not zero, but down into the 30s. So we're cutting that fatigue in half, I would say. And we're giving people tools to work around their problem. And in some cases, we're eliminating some pieces, such as a migraine that hadn't been discovered before, or a better treatment for an orthostatic problem, so that they can physiologically function better.
Fabulous. I'm so glad that you're having positive results. Thank you so much for your time today. I think we'd love to come back and have another conversation. You'd previously suggested we speak to your wife. Perhaps we could do a roundtable with you and Dr. Garbo and Dr. Wells, and maybe just actually have an open conversation about this. Interesting, the discussion of the overlaps of these things. And the other thing is that he's noticed this problem, which is POTS-like symptoms, but it's not necessarily related to standing, which I think is something that I've had a lot of dizziness. And I do get really dizzy when I stand up, but I didn't pass a tilt table test. I passed the lean test. I get dizzy, but I don't have necessarily the heart rate variability in changes of posture.
I didn't pass my tilt table. I failed.
Oh, you did really badly at the tilt table. Or maybe you did really well at the tilt table. Maybe that's how you really, really scored highly on the tilt table in terms of how bad you were. You passed out.
I passed out. And then the week before, I'd passed out at the Royal Brompton, remember, doing the exercise test.
I miss you coming over here for me to come and rescue you. We've had some lovely days.
Yeah, I mean, touch wood, this winter, normally we really do go pretty downhill in the winters. We haven't been too bad this year.
Yeah.
And the summers are normally quite kind to us.
Yeah.
Except for last summer, you had a pretty bad crash and so did I. Having said that, our memory is so selective.
Yeah, it's our long COVID amnesia.
I was telling my husband something the other day and my words were all jumbly. And yet I could remember some other stuff perfectly, like where every item is in the house.
But I definitely have such mental impairment when I'm like this in this situation. I struggle with everything much more. Everything is hard work when you feel crap. But it's now noticeable the days that I wake up and have to take painkillers, whereas there were periods when I was having to take things every single day to get out of bed. So I'm really grateful that I am generally doing better, and it's almost a shock now when I feel this crap.
The constriction in your throat, I don't think you've mentioned for at least a year.
No. And I think, do you know what it is? I was trying to describe this feeling that I have to a friend. I think it might come from my heart. It feels, and I've talked before, it feels like I have this strange pressure that pushes up my chest and up my neck, and the same pressure that comes around in my head, but it's a real kind of pressure in my throat.
So your throat or your jaw?
It's my throat.
Okay, because jaw is heart related to heart, I believe.
Is it? I don't know, the pain all kind of blends into one.
And the tremors, you do suffer with tremors quite significantly. I mean, today, normally when you wave your hands around, I can see if they're shaking, but today your whole body's shaking.
I thought that was one thing that had definitely alleviated somewhat. Anyway, we can muddle through this. Here's to the next 4 years.
Don't say that.
If 5 years is the trajectory, we're going to be fine by next year.
Did we ever think that when we started this podcast that we'd be still doing it 4 years in?
I didn't, but I think now you've always said we're never getting better. And I've always said, oh, I'm better. I am much more accepting. And I think that I've reached a level of life that if this is it forever, it's actually okay. It's manageable. I can still live my life. Whereas there was a bit there where I really did not have a life. So, yeah, it's all right.
It's like sliding doors. We went through a door and now we have this altered reality of what our life is.
Yeah. And accepting that has been a massive deal for me, but I think one of the best things. I'm still going to tell you that I've recovered every single week. Okay.
That's fine. And I'm still going to tell you that this is it now. That's why we make such a good team.
I know. It's a nice balance, isn't it?
Yeah. Woo woo, okay. Yin and yang.
Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.